You can go to Lake Mead and enjoy a lot of things, swimming, boating, even take in the scenery below the dam in Black Canyon. But here's one you might not know. There's a landmark, and it's officially recognized by the National Register of Historic Places, at the bottom of the lake. It's a B-29 super fortress, and it crashed into Lake Mead in 1948. And recently, a group of photographers and archaeologists went down there to take pictures and document the wreckage. Brett Seymour is a deputy chief and photographer for the Submerged Resources Center, and he recently took some pretty stunning pictures of the plane. Brett Seymour joins us now. Brett, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
So you went down to photograph this wreckage most recently in March. For the vast majority of us who are only going to see this plane through your pictures, what did you see?
Well, it's a fascinating sight, and that's the primary reason for the photography, is to show the people who won't be able to access that particular site, and that's generally what the Submerged Resources Center does across the country for the National Park Service. In Lake Mead's case, what you have is the greatest technology available at World War II, and it's sitting there in the bottom of the lake. Due to its depth and its remote location, it's in very good shape. When we first started looking at it several years ago, it was as if you could fly it away. There was the aluminum skin kind of glistened in the lights, and it's pretty much completely intact. So it's an amazing sight.
As I said, it was 1948. What do we know about the crash itself?
Well, the crash is actually kind of one of those things. Looking back to the historical record, it's almost comical in some ways. The crash report says that the scientist on board, a gentleman named Simaroff, was conducting upper atmospheric research, and he requested of the pilot that they, quote, fly as low as possible on the last pass of the day, and the pilot took him at his word.
You obliged,
the,
yeah.
Exactly, due to the glass flat level of the lake, just clearly a windless day. The pilot had a difficult time actually judging his distance, and they had taken off from an airport that had some altitude attached to it, so their altimeters were set slightly off. So unbeknownst to the pilot, of course, the lowest pass of the day, he simply drove the plane right into Lake Mead, hit the water, I think about 250 miles an hour, skidded up about a quarter mile, and then came to rest on the lake with three of the engines removed, and one of them was still there, and the plane rested on the lake surface for a while. Everyone was able to get out, and then the plane vanished.
Now, this particular plane was known as a super fortress. Give us a sense of the scale here. How big is this thing?
Massive. So if you could think along the lines of today's commercial jet airliners, obviously the body wasn't as big. It didn't, have a need for so many passengers, so to speak. But the wingspan is very significant. And one of the things that is quite humbling is, on planes, we tend to walk around and look at planes, either in museums or, kind of at airports and those kind of things. The fascinating thing about the B-29 at Lake Mead is just kind of the ability to swim over it, if you will, and you really get a sense of scale by how long it takes you to kind of swim from one end to the other of the plane. It's quite a large sight.
How well has it been preserved at the bottom of the lake?
Well, the lake has actually done, kind of wonders for this historical resource. People have kind of a general misconception that things underwater tend to just quickly fall apart and decay, but that's generally not the case, especially in Lake Mead with a freshwater environment, and most of the plane was built of aluminum. So the condition was actually very, very good, and I say that with a little bit of hesitancy because as of late, with the issue of invasive species at Lake Mead, and specifically the quagga mussels have come in. So the quagga mussels have actually used the B-29 as kind of a substrate, if you will, kind of an attachment point. So the plane has been covered with quagga mussels at this point. But that really is just kind of affecting the aluminum skin and how it looks, so to speak. In terms of structural integrity, as I said, it has a break in it in the back, as we call it, before the tail. And then three of the engines are missing. But for the most part, everything is still there. And when I say everything, gauges and there's parachutes between the seats. There's some oxygen cylinders on the bottom of the lake. And, there's a lot of material that's still there, which is why the National Park Service was very interested and kind of preserving it and protecting it, you know, so that's something that will be there as a future resource to examine.
Now, there was a battle for ownership of this wreckage at one point. Can you describe what happened when a team of divers using sonar first located the wreckage?
Yeah, so, I mean, early on, as you mentioned, a group of divers actually located the plane using a side scan sonar, which is illegal in all national parks, period, or recreation areas. Once they located it, they had been diving on it for quite some time without the Park Service, you know, being notified, of course. And then the Park Service actually first found out about the discovery when they held a press conference to kind of reveal it in the Las Vegas media. The National Park Service has known about this particular site for decades and decades. You know, there's again material in the historic record that was actually involved in the rescue of these people when the plane crashed. But it was something that, you know, the Park Service knew was there, but without a pertinent need to go and protect it, largely because of the depth of the water at the time. It was well over 250 feet deep. We didn't really think it was a resource that we could expend the funds, you know, to go look for. So when it was located, it was basically, you know, a group of individuals who thought because they found it, they could keep it, you know. So the Park Service didn't really feel that was appropriate. So, yeah, a court battle ensued. And basically what was determined through the legal system was that this was a federal aircraft in federally protected areas or a national recreational area, as it were, which is what Lake Mead is. And therefore, it belonged to the American public and was administered and or kind of protected by the National Park Service.
Do you think that's the best place for it?
I do, actually, and I don't, you know, I don't say that. People ask that a lot, actually, and I have to say, well, of course I do, because I'm a scuba diver. However, you know, in one of the things the National Park Service did in looking at if this was the best place for the plane was look at, you know, other areas of B-29 around the country, and more specifically in a very kind of centralized location to Lake Mead. So there were several other instances of B-29s where you could kind of go to a museum. Of course, the most famous, the Enola Gay and the Smithsonian, but there's also, you know, B-29s in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for instance, that the general public can go and get a sense of what's there. This particular resource, you know, is lying in the bottom of Lake Mead, and yes, access is an issue because clearly a lot of people, a lot of the general public will never see the site, but what the National Park Service has done is to try to address some of those questions by generating the materials that we've generated, so a site map, historical research to tell the story of the plane, interpretive panels for the national park, or excuse me, the national recreation area there at Lake Mead, and as you mentioned in the opening of the piece, photography. You know, we take great care in trying to both document the site for preservation purposes, but more importantly for outreach and education to tell people the story of the B-29 and how it, you know, came to rest in this really remarkable underwater environment.
So tell us about your most recent dive down to the site. How many people went down there with you?
There was three people with us with the National Park Service, and we periodically do dives on the site just to check on it, just as kind of an inventorying and monitoring is what we call in the National Park Service. And we over the years have used that particular site as a training site as well, simply because of its depth. So there's three individuals with us, two National Park Service divers from here in the Submerged Resources Center, and then one instructor that was with us. We were also doing some mixed gas dive training while we were there. So we dropped down, and in this particular trip, that these last round of imagery that we generated, the visibility was quite remarkable, you know, better than I had seen it in many, many years. So what it enabled us to do, in particular me as the photographer, was to get a little bit better sense of how big the aircraft is by utilizing some kind of natural light long exposure shots that show, you know, kind of the scale and the size of the tail versus a diver or the size of the fuselage. So we actually were very fortunate with the visibility and were able to generate some imagery that I think, you know, like I mentioned before, helps tell the story of both the scale and this interesting resource.
And now you took a pretty striking image of that wreckage and focusing on that tail. It appeared in the High Country News. Can you describe that photo for us?
Yeah, so the photo basically just shows, you know, I keep mentioning the word scale. It shows the size of this plane. So it's basically a black and white image. With a diver or two kind of at the stern or the back of the tail, and they're just simply looking up with a light, and the vertical stabilizer just kind of seems to go on and on and on. And having the diver in the frame really, you know, a 6 foot, 5.5 foot, 6 foot individual, really gives a sense of scale of how large that tail section is, and that, kind of extrapolated out over the entire plane, it's quite massive.
Mm. You document all kinds of underwater resources for the Park Service. How does the B-29 stand out compared to other underwater sites?
Well, the B-29 actually is very, very well intact. I have spent a large part of my career looking at World War II specific planes, and this, of course, was just shortly after World War II, but looking at tanks and Allied and Japanese aircraft across the country, but also in the South Pacific. And this particular resource, by far, is in better shape than any that I've seen, and that has a lot to do with the conditions that it came to rest in, predominantly the freshwater environment, the dark and deep freshwater environment that Lake Mead kind of used to be, if you will, since before the lake level started dropping. So it's in a remarkable condition. And not only the composition or the structural integrity of the aircraft, but the things associated with it. You know, it's very rare to have a site like that, a World War II era site, that is so intact. Gauges in the console, and if you peer in to the cockpit, there's actually the headset that the co-pilot was wearing resting on the control stick. You know, it's still sitting there. There's a parachute that's draped between the co-pilot and pilot seat. You know, there's all of these little nuances, all of these things that kind of, help preserve the story, but also these artifacts that are still left in place. And that's kind of what the National Park Service is looking to do with this particular site, is just, keep it as intact as possible so that as many people can enjoy it either through the photography or through firsthand experience.
In Canada, in the province of Ontario, there is one park. It's called Fathom 5 National Park, and it's actually a collection of shipwrecks, I think, at the bottom of a portion of Lake Huron. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think of things like this and think this is an important part of our heritage. Is it something that should be preserved for future generations?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Fathom 5. I was just up there last year working with Parks Canada on doing some filming to help them tell their story as well. And, in answer to your question, absolutely. I mean, we are, by default, a maritime nation. I mean, we exist and we have built our nation on these maritime themes. And the ability to have this history submerged does two things. One, it keeps it kind of, there's a certain sense of discovery with it, and it keeps these resources intact. But yes, I think that as a maritime nation, we have both the responsibility to preserve these areas as much as possible, because they do tell the story of our history, and then also to have them accessible to the public. You know, that's the National Park Service treats underwater sites, for the most part, very similar to we treat, topside or land-based sites, just as we have backcountry trails in the National Park Service or scenic vistas or views or historic resources in the portfolio of the National Park Service. We have these underwater sites that really, unfortunately, because they're out of sight, out of mind, have this kind of forgotten mentality, but that's largely what the Submerged Resources Center does, is help parks assess these sites and interpret them for the American public so they understand, both the importance and the need to preserve these areas.
Brett Seymour is the deputy chief of and a photographer for the Submerged Resources Center for the National Park Service. Brett Seymour, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.